Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In the next hour, we're talking about elder abuse. Cases of elder abuse have risen in recent years, and we're talking about that issue with adult social worker Angie Keeler and Deputy Director Dave Longsdorf with the Douglas County Health and Human Services Department. They talk to us about the work that they do and what they're seeing.
We work with adults with mental health issues, adults with alcohol and drug issues. We do the DUI assessments for recovery of driver's licenses, and a big portion of what we do is referred to as adult protection, which is a statutorily determined program. We provide assistance to those that either are suffering elder abuse, neglect, adults at risk, and ultimately those individuals who are unable to care for themselves. We actually do what's referred to as Chapter 55 services, guardianship and protective placement.
I am the frontline direct care service worker that basically provides all those services. So it really does vary day to day what we do here, kind of along the spectrum, like Dave had mentioned, with, you know, folks suffering from mental illness or chemical dependency issues, but then also getting into the later life and the issues that arise with folks, you know, with aging.
So is it kind of a mixture of things that face, you know, aging patients or people with dementia, or is it one particular issue that seems to be coming up more often?
We're primarily a crisis-oriented unit, and so when an individual's in crisis, and that's when we're contacted, and we have to look at whether or not that individual is competent to make their own decisions or need an alternate decision-maker. So if they are competent, then we provide information, referral, and some support, and help guide them from those issues. If they're deemed incompetent, then we work with either friends, family, or a corporate guardian to establish guardianship and protective placement. So we're really working for safety and welfare.
So how have you seen things change since you took this position?
Sure.
You know, how would you characterize the issue right now as far as adult protection?
The number of adult protection cases has increased, I would say, over the last 4 or 5 years. I would say by as much as 50 to 70%. And again, it may be in part to the community's recognition of these issues, but also this is an aging community. And so those issues will oftentimes start to surface more. But I would certainly believe it's primarily due to the recognition by the community. And so hospitals, law enforcement, friends, family, other providers, nursing homes, you name it, they all come forward and provide referrals that require us to intervene.
So what's needed for adequate adult protection, or what are those demands that you're seeing?
That's a really complex question, because there's a lot of needs. The more we can engage in natural supports, the better off the individual is. Part of our role is to really navigate the least restrictive setting to maintain that person's safety. So we work with other community providers as well as the Aging and Disability Resource Center to try to provide opportunities for people to remain in their home as much as they can, perhaps with the assistance of personal care attendants or CNAs, other programs that might need to come in. And this may even include engaging them in the family care system, which is what we work with the Aging and Disability Resource Center with. As far as needs are concerned, the biggest need is for friends and family to provide that natural support. But when that is not available, or if the issue is greater than the capacity of individuals, then we need to start engaging in professional services. And that's where we start looking at the things that we do, which is providing those court-ordered pieces, the guardianship protective placement, but also we'd be looking at assisted living, nursing homes, and other equivalent care.
What are the things that you're seeing then with those more difficult cases, with the court-ordered?
Every case is so unique, and so I hesitate to generalize, but as far as nursing homes, we have a number of nursing homes locally, but when you're starting to talk about concurrent cases where you're looking at maybe significant mental health and maybe dementia or other aging-related disabilities, you need specialized facilities for folks like that to give them the adequate care. We're part of a consortium with some other counties for a facility in Clark County. And there are other consortiums throughout the state that actually provide specialized services.
So as far as the specialized services that are provided, do you feel like those are adequate to meet the need, or that there's a need for more types of facilities?
It's my belief that there have not been individuals whose needs have not been met. The staff here work diligently to try to find the best outcome. Sometimes it doesn't happen as rapidly as we'd like it to happen, and we have to look out of county. So perhaps, you know, certainly if there were more facilities locally that could do that, then the individual would be closer to friends and family. But I would say regionally, we've had adequate resources.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement. I think that it's the rare occasion that we come across in our work individuals that have such unique needs that we can't find an appropriate placement or facility to help meet those needs. And when we do come across those situations, we, you know, work real hard with the resources that we have first, closer to home. That's always our first kind of plan of action. And then when we, you know, can't meet their needs here locally, then we start to look, you know, further away from their community. But that's not the common occurrence, I would say. That's not typical. I think that when you talk about rural communities, obviously you're looking at probably way less resources locally. I think one of the advantages that we have here is also the access to some services across the bridge to Duluth that we're close to. So sometimes in those situations, individuals in the immediate crisis situation, let's say in the middle of the night, if there's nothing close, then they're brought over to Duluth. And then still we are involved. The hospitals will, you know, correspond with us. So we may have that advantage over some of the more rural, where they're further away from the bigger city type situation.
So I guess, you know, as you're working to meet the needs of people that you encounter through adult protection, what are those things that still need to be done or enhanced?
Community education. And then that's really kind of the drive of what we're both ourselves and the state are working towards. Right now there's a two-part training that my staff and several other individuals in the community are attending on dementia and being able to identify and work with. And present was law enforcement and a number of other people kind of on the front line working with people with dementia. And I think that's important. You know, oftentimes when you look at an issue in the household, the first person to arrive is law enforcement. And they have to quickly make a decision what to do with that individual, whether it's a mental health or whether it's, you know, it's dementia or whatever it might be. And it's not really their role to play the diagnostician. And so the more education that we can provide law enforcement, the more we can provide the social workers that do that are the front line of the work, the more we can provide even businesses so they identify it and they know who to contact, I think is a really important piece.
Can you give me an example then of the kind of tools that would benefit law enforcement?
Well, simply identification. Looking at, you know, maybe for some key characteristics, it's not likely that somebody that's 35 years old is going to have dementia. And so it's more often than not a safe assumption that perhaps they're dealing with a behavioral health issue. But to be able to identify maybe some basic characteristics of what dementia is, perhaps some strategies on working with the individual to de-escalate them, those sorts of things.
And so how new is that then, working on those types of trainings and interactions between agencies?
I definitely see that there is an interest from law enforcement, and I think especially since there's been changes in the state and there's new information coming forward, especially with the numbers out that, you know, the northern parts of Wisconsin has the, you know, a large growing aging population. So I have seen law enforcement attending some of the important meetings on dementia, the dementia redesign. We also have an I team here at Douglas County, which is an interdisciplinary team that is comprised of several providers in the community that is focused on elder abuse and vulnerable adult situations. And so I think there's a definite interest there. And I also think we are lucky to have a strong, we have a good relationship with law enforcement when it comes to dealing with some of these unique situations. I feel that they do reach out to us and we work together collaboratively to address some of these things that come up with folks. So I guess I have a pretty positive feel about it. It's kind of all new information to all of us. We're kind of all learning right now, you know, how to meet these needs. And I think we're doing pretty good so far.
Well, and you talked about other issues related to dementia patients or people living with dementia, like elder abuse or fraud. And what would you characterize as what you're seeing in those areas?
I mean, elder abuse, I think, encompasses several different areas. You know, you have the physical, emotional abuse, you have neglect by caregivers and self-neglect, and you have financial exploitation. I would say that the most common report or referral we get is financial exploitation, and that's generally by someone they know. I think if I were to assume, I haven't done numbers or research on this, but I would assume that's partially because we live in kind of a depressed economy and a lot of people share households here. So you have a lot of sharing of resources and incomes. That's probably the number one area that we deal with the elder abuse, vulnerable adult, and then going into then more of the aging and needing to determine competency. And by that kind of, you know, families or friends or neighbors are calling us or hospitals saying, you know, I'm not sure if this person's able to make good decisions anymore for themselves. So that's, you know, when we sometimes become involved, kind of taking a look at that and how to keep them safe. And whether or not we need to help them get a substitute decision maker. So those are probably two of the biggies that we see more often than not.
Can you give me an example, too, of like the kind of financial exploitation that you see?
Commonly, we'll see someone's adult child that's residing with them, maybe using their bank account or their credit card or their checking account card, that kind of exploitation. Or, you know, it's generally where the individual is vulnerable, maybe, you know, not able to make those good decisions anymore. And it's usually someone they know that's taking their money or taking an advantage of them. That way, whether it's, like I said, a card type of crime or actually just getting them to withdraw money out of the bank or taking out, you know, loans in their name, these types of things. So it's that's generally the most common thing we see, I would say.
Sometimes it's even unintentional. Again, Angie had commented that you have multiple people living in a household, and one person may be using a considerable sum of the other individual's money for their own purposes. Some folks will just look at it as that they're just using the family funds and don't recognize what kind of position they're putting their loved one in. And so there's times that it's education, there's times that it's reporting to law enforcement after investigation.
The other thing that we do see oftentimes is the power of attorney, the abuse of the power of attorney, and the certain rights and roles and responsibilities that an individual has given their, you know, loved one or friend or whoever it may be that they have appointed as their agent, and then that person inappropriately using, you know, the person's funds or just not abiding by the responsibilities of the power of attorney.
Well, and you talked about trying to pinpoint signs of that abuse taking place. And so who are you training to see those signs then? I mean, I imagine it's difficult for the folks living with dementia to see that because their memory is not so good anymore.
Usually it ends up being either a concerned friend or family. It could be a bank, you know, calling and saying, I've seen somebody withdraw 9 times out of so-and-so's account. It could be something that was acknowledged while in the hospital. Then the social workers of this unit go out, they investigate, they speak to those, you know, to friends and family, that are involved. And if it looks quite likely that there is exploitation going on, then they file a report with the police department.
So you said this often, what you see, but would you say you're seeing more investigations or the same as far as how long you've been doing this?
I would say it has increased, yes. Like Dave said earlier, I think in the last couple of years, we have seen an increase in referrals. And again, I think it's hard to kind of pinpoint, though, how many of those are actual exploitation and how many of those are, you know, just needing more information, maybe not, you know, understanding that what they were doing was, you know, inappropriate. So, but overall, I would say our referrals have increased just in the, you know, vulnerable adult elder abuse category.
So what are the challenges that you see then in going forward, knowing what you are dealing with and the issues that have cropped up? What is it that your office would need?
I mean, if the numbers of our community continue to age, I mean, there's going to need to be more resources to provide cares for those individuals. You know, whether it be friends and family offering natural support or, you know, different agencies providing home health care or even more nursing care. Again, it appears that the amount of resources we have right now, you know, meet the vast majority of the needs that we have. And it's the very individual, unique and individual case that we may struggle with a little bit. But certainly, you know, if the numbers increase, we're going to need more resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, you know, just in the some of the conferences I've been at, I hear kind of the trend is that even the home health care workers and the individuals that that provide those direct cares in the home, let's say, so we have an aging population, and then there's a shortage of, you know, the providers that are doing a lot of the cares in the home to, you know, ensure that people can live independently as possibly in their homes. And so that seems to be a concern for folks, that there's a shortage of those types of staff.
Well, what do you think is driving that? I've heard that, you know, the wages of personal care workers or CNAs doesn't really meet the quality of service that they provide. Is that part of it?
That'd be hard to say. What I can say is it's very demanding work. It's work that I think people aren't able to maintain for long periods of time. And so I believe they have turnover.
Because of the stress and demands of the job.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess, what do you want people to know then as far as issues related to adult protection and trying to protect the most vulnerable adults in our community? What do people need to focus on? What do they need to know?
If they believe that somebody is at risk, they need to report it.
Yep, that there's a number to call. That's, you know, one of the trainings that I had presented at last summer at UW-Superior. It was focused around elder abuse. I was just so surprised at how many people in the audience, I think we had over 75 people in attendance, a great majority of them didn't even know that there was a number to call for suspected abuse of elders or vulnerable adults, and that was pretty concerning to me. So I think, number one, you know, getting the message out there that there is a number to call if there are concerns.
I might word this wrong, but, like, is there a shift taking place, too, between how people are choosing to care for one? You talk about trying to keep people in their home, or that yeah. preference for independence. And, you know, is it also to something related to economic situations for families that you kind of touched on? Because in this day and age, it's just more expensive to put someone in a home than it would be to have family to take care of their aging relatives?
Best practice is to really keep people in the least restrictive setting. I mean, you know, we all want to live in our own home, and we want to, you know, and to continue that lifestyle as long as we can. And, you know, we do our very best to provide, you know, for the respect and dignity of the individual, and to try to meet those wishes when we can. You know, as far as, you know, advanced dementia especially can be really hard. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of good intention, friends and family, that would like to do the best they can. But, you know, there is a point where people sometimes feel like they just can't do it anymore, or it's just not safe to do it anymore in the household. And that's mm-hmm. when these, you know, more restrictive placements come into being.
You know, I have seen that, you know, that there is quite a cost to long-term care and facilities for families. And so when you're talking about, you know, having a loved one move into a long-term care facility, depending on their insurance, depending on their assets. I mean, those are all major factors for families to keep into consideration. And for the individual themselves, they don't want to put their family, you know, put this burden on their family of having to have the financial obligation for them to be moving out of the home and into a long-term care facility. I definitely think that is a factor, you know, preventing some from going into long-term care facilities. But I also think on the flip side that, you know, folks with dementia and that are aging, and there's multiple medical issues generally, that is a lot for families to provide all the care for. And especially going off of what we talked about earlier, is that there is a shortage of good healthcare providers to keep people in their homes. And so these are tough situations for families to have to kind of wade through to determine, do we have mom or dad go to, you know, nursing facility and pay X amount, or do we keep them home, maybe quit a job or retire early to provide 24-hour care? So, I mean, these are big, big decisions for families. And I, you know, definitely have been a part of some of those conversations. And so, you know, what we do in adult protection is sit down and provide education about resources and try to make sure that they're connected with the appropriate benefits, you know, try to maximize whatever benefits they have and working with them and looking at different facilities or whatever it may be.
So you talked about the need to provide more services, too. And so is it more, providing more financial support for caregivers or family members? Or is it those services like nursing homes or assisted living centers? Or is it both? Or is it people to care for those living with dementia?
Maybe all of the above.
Exactly.
In a perfect world, there's a plethora of everything. And in any community, there's a finite amount of all those things. And so it's the best way to kind of triage what do we get for someone. With that constant, and I know I sound like a broken record, but that constant focus on quality of life and how can we assure that the person's in the least restrictive setting.
And that's what the court looks at. I mean, so if we're talking about an individual that's unable to make decisions anymore and we're moving forward with, like Dave mentioned earlier, guardianship protective placement is what it's called in Wisconsin law, the court is always looking at the least restrictive placement. So we always have to make sure that, I mean, and oftentimes that's looking at can we get, close to 24-hour services in the home before the individual would ever go to a nursing home. And we've done that before. But, of course, there's a cost to that. So it just every case is so different.
Anything else that I'm missing that either of you would like to add about the issues that you're seeing and what you'd like to be able to do?
One thing I did want to add is that I'm pretty excited. I think that there has been some kind of positive energy about learning about dementia in this community and trying to kind of, work together, the different agencies, different providers, community members, trying to figure out, that this is a growing aging population. This is going to be, something that we're going to be faced with. And so people are coming together and some good things are happening. Coming up on May 24th at UW-Superior, we're having an all-day conference talking about elder abuse awareness and prevention. There will be various topics during the day, whether it's financial exploitation, talking about what to look for abuse, neglect, who to report to. And that's a collaboration between both Douglas County and St. Louis County, which is pretty neat. So it's kind of getting the perspective from both counties because we are a border community. There will be law enforcement, banks, hospital, representation all across the board. So I'm pretty excited about that. This is the second year we're having it. And before that, nothing like this has ever happened in our community.
Again, you've been listening to adult social worker Angie Keeler and Deputy Director Dave Longsdorf with the Douglas County Health and Human Services Department. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. And when we come back, we'll talk with Stan Szymanski with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services about what they're seeing statewide. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we've been talking about cases of elder abuse, and next we speak with Stan Szymanski. Szymanski is a policy analyst and elder abuse specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and he spoke with us last week over the phone about the work that they're doing and what they're seeing statewide.
I work with a number of people in the Office on Aging who are responsible for providing technical assistance to our partners in the field. Wisconsin is a state that is, programming is county-driven, so we provide technical assistance when APS workers have difficulty with a particular case, are looking for some guidance, and I work alongside Alice Page, who is in the Office on Aging, and we work under Cindy Ofsted, who is part of the long-term care division here in the state.
And I guess, what can you tell me about the numbers of referrals that you've seen across counties in the state? I mean, is it more elder abuse or is it vulnerable adults?
Well, APS has now taken on kind of an umbrella over both elder abuse as well as adults at risk. Adults at risk being the 18 to 59-year-old, our elder adults, of course, 60 and beyond. As far as what we see as driving the numbers, in recent years, we've had a groundswell of campaigns that have provided a lot of awareness and education at the local level, the state level, and even the World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which started in 2006, and it is June 15th on an annual basis, and actually the whole month of June is pretty much devoted to programming that directs people's attention towards the ever-growing incidence of elder and adult at-risk abuse. Wisconsin also has a very good network of ADRCs, or Aging and Disability Resource Centers, which have become a good focal point for individuals to be able to contact if they have any suspicions or questions about elder abuse. Wisconsin has a requirement that every county has a designated lead and agency where people can call and report incidents of alleged elder or adult at-risk abuse. They've also have I-teams, interdisciplinary teams, which have really provided a lot of education and outreach throughout the state. The I-teams are made up of individuals who really are stakeholders in the elder abuse and adult at-risk reporting, to include law enforcement, hospital emergency rooms, facilities, and, of course, those county APS workers.
And so have you seen any change as far as the numbers or referrals that you're seeing based on either, you know, increased reporting or just more incidents of abuse? Or?
Well, I think that the one thing that we've seen, I know that I don't know who came up with the name, but they're calling financial exploitation the crime of the 21st century. And I think even if the numbers of cases of suspected elder abuse have not grown dramatically, the intensity of the cases, the adult protective service workers throughout the state really have a lot on their shoulders as far as going through and putting together the pieces to be able to turn things over if necessary to prosecutors or law enforcement. I think that that probably has cast the greatest burden out there. And reporting, Danielle, we really are dependent on the counties to they're mandated to report to us, and we have to have a source for them to put the reports in. But again, that data, I think that my colleague, Eric Grasso, who is our demographer, has provided you with a number of reports throughout the last couple of years.
And I think it was looking at 2014, and it was somewhere around 6,300 cases total. And do you have any updated figures of what you're seeing statewide?
It's increased, and it's increased. You know, right now we're working on 2015. Counties have the ability to put the reports in for the previous year by March 31st of the current year. So we don't have final numbers for 2015 as of yet, but I believe that we should be able to be putting together the reports for both the elder abuse as well as the adults at risk in the very near future. And again, I think that Wisconsin has been known for a long time for the system that we have. We call it WITS, the Wisconsin Incident Tracking System, and it breaks down the type of case, you know, whether or not the individual who opened the investigation was able to substantiate, meaning that, yes, elder abuse did occur, was unable to substantiate. In other words, based on all of the information that they were given, it was not a case of elder abuse. However, they still would be providing recommendations for services that might provide for a better life for that individual. And the last category is unable to substantiate. Doing their due diligence and getting all of the information as necessary, they still are not able to determine whether or not that was in fact a case of abuse.
So, you know, I know you said that you don't have final numbers yet, but do you have any idea going through it right now why it has increased? or what's driving that?
Well, I think a number of reasons are. First of all, back to that campaign of public awareness, that has really been a major point. The department here at the state does an enormous amount of outreach in assisting with reporting and helping respective counties understand what needs to be reported. And so I think that that may be one of the major reasons that there are an increase in the number of reports. Furthermore, we're seeing our aging population grow, and in a lot of cases, those are individuals who are vulnerable, both from a financial standpoint, and we've also learned that if there is financial exploitation going on, it's a very good probability that there are other forms of abuse as well.
Okay, and is it that financial exploitation then that's the top factor, or
self-neglect has been for a long time the number one form of abuse. Self-neglect being that an individual has either lost the capacity to make decisions or understand how their decisions impact their life, taking care of their adult daily living skills, safety issues, mobility issues, all of those things kind of play into the self-neglect. But I can tell you that financial exploitation is fast on the heels of self-neglect.
And, you know, one thing I was hearing, because I talked to the Greater Wisconsin, I forget the acronym is GWAR, but I talked to them and they said that the amount of funding to investigate cases that has come down from the federal government hasn't really changed over the years. And are you hearing anything from counties about, you know, the challenges that they're facing in investigating these cases?
Well, I think that the challenges are many. And I think that across the board, people always try to point to the financial aspect of it. But I think that there also is a need that we hear about very often is how do we get the stakeholders and the impacted individuals at the table? And that's where those I teams are so critical. We've got to begin looking at financial exploitation as a criminal act, not just taking grandma's money. It is literally a crime, regardless of who the perpetrator is. And historically, we've had some issues with being able to get everybody working collectively. I think that's changed dramatically. I think it's improved greatly over the last 6-10 years, and hopefully it'll continue in that direction.
So, and with the financial exploitation piece, too, I mean, is it intentional or unintentional?
I think at times it's passive. In other words, I think an individual who doesn't understand what they're doing and how that is impacting the elder. In Wisconsin, we're very fortunate. We have many very qualified and very good caregivers, many family members who truly want to do the very best that they can. And, of course, there's always going to be those individuals who see the elder or the vulnerable adult as a resource to support their lifestyle, or things that not necessarily do any good at all and perhaps harm for that elder.
And so you said this needs to be recognized as a criminal act, and it's not currently?
Well, I think that at times there has been a feeling or a sentiment, particularly in families, where people have a hard time seeing somebody in their family, a grandson, a nephew, a son being prosecuted. That's a very difficult thing. It's a very sensitive issue. And not only are the elders in many instances concerned about the, you know, family member, but they're also concerned what's going to happen to me if, in fact, I end up doing something that causes an issue for the individual that may be financially exploiting me, but they're still my caregiver and my family. So that does come up on occasion as a major issue. And again, you know, that is a very difficult circumstance for that APS worker in the field to work, get the trust, and work with that elder to be able to get them at a point where they are willing to, you know, report.
Because most of the time it's a family member that they love, and then they're worried about, you know, what's going to happen to them, or if there's going to be backlash from them reporting that, or maybe it's just a misunderstanding, things like that.
I think that what you're saying makes a great deal of sense. And I think in a nutshell, that really is probably one of the primary reasons why there is not more reporting from family itself.
So what do you think needs to happen then as the state and counties address issues with elder abuse? What is some of the things that's taking your attention?
Well, one thing that's taking my attention in the work that I do is how do you go out and change a culture and get people to see the ramifications of elder abuse and those individuals who are vulnerable, adults at risk. You know, first of all, to think that somebody's dignity has been trampled on and their, you know, right to quiet enjoyment and all of those things that different levels of abuse seem to impact. But above and beyond that, if the resources that individual had in order to maintain their living circumstance and their care have been depleted by some nefarious act, well, I think the answer is obvious. What happens next? That individual has to seek resources outside their own in order to be able to be their needs met.
Anything that I'm missing that you would like to add about the work that you're doing?
No, I'll tell you what, I think, Danielle, this type of exposure in the public arena is so critical. I think every year when the Elder Abuse World Awareness Day takes place, whenever we go to meetings, the Elder Abuse APS conference that's held every other year throughout the state, I think those things are really a major factor in getting people to understand that there is a course of action there. They don't have to just worry about what's going to happen next. They know that there are resources to make the reports and that there are individuals on the other end who really do care and want to make things as comfortable and as good for those individuals who have been victims.
So what, you know, in those conversations that take place, you know, if you're seeing instances where seniors are being exploited by their family members, what are some of the things that you tell them to encourage them to report that activity?
Well, Danielle, I've been out of the field now for over 3 years, and so it's not that I've lost my entire perspective on that, but I think that working with people who are in the field, I want to go back to the fact that building that relationship of trust and knowing that as difficult as it may be to take that step to report, I think knowing that there is going to be somebody there that's going to walk them through it and stick with them and make sure that nobody is taking advantage of them from any walk outside of their own is what's critical. So.
And I know you said that you haven't crunched all the numbers yet, but do you have an estimate? I mean, you seem to have a good idea that it has increased.
Well, it has every year, and, you know, we have 72 counties and 11 tribes, and we get reports that trickle through the year, and then there's a great big onslaught that typically comes from, you know, in the last couple of months when people have had a case pending, and they will then report into our Wisconsin incident tracking system. So I hate to speculate on a number, you know. Truthfully, I don't want to say that I hope it increases because I'm hoping that the incidence of abuse at any level increased. I think it would demonstrate that there are more people out there getting the word out and making those reports so that we do get that information. And then it helps us and look at what areas are necessary for training. There's a great training program going on through UWO right now that's dealing with dementia, part of our dementia redesign, and I think that too is going to help us a great deal in caregivers recognizing if somebody is in fact moving towards becoming more and more vulnerable. So I believe that the numbers are going to increase, and I'm hopeful that they do, because that way we have a better hold on knowing that the word is getting out there, which, you know, a report like this is going to help with. I hope that's clear to you.
Yeah. Anything else that you would consider helpful as you're going about doing this work to try and address elder abuse?
continue to educate people and make sure that we have the best level of response there, which I believe we do. I really do. I have a lot of faith in our partners out there in the field. Seen some very good efforts, people constantly wanting to share with us what's happening in the field, a lot of outreach from our offices out there to make sure that we also are supporting their efforts.
Again, that was Stan Szymanski, policy analyst and elder abuse specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Still to come, we'll speak with Jane Mullins, who is with the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources, about their work on elder abuse. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Good evening. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. In this hour, we've been talking about elder abuse. And in our last segment, we speak with Jane Mullins. She's with the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources, and she spoke with us about the money they receive from state and federal sources and how that addresses elder abuse cases and investigations.
Especially with the aging of the population, in many instances, the cases people are dealing with are just really multifaceted in that they're not just seeing that an individual may have been financially abused, that oftentimes there's other things going on. There may be a situation where the individual who is financially abusing them may be a family member who is also responsible for providing care to them and may be neglecting to do that at the level that they should be or agreed to do. You know, and they're finding that even nationally, that oftentimes it's not just one type of abuse. There's usually a couple of other things going on. There may be threats, like if you don't give me the money, I'm not going to take you to your doctor's appointment, those kinds of things. But I don't, as I said, I don't do direct services, so certainly you might find it helpful to maybe talk to a social worker or two about their own experiences, like in the field.
Okay, but you said that you distribute state or federal money to the counties?
Our agency administers, distributes federal and state dollars under the Old Americans Act to the counties, and then the state has a separate allocation that goes to the counties where every county is required to designate a lead elder abuse agency. As I said, they may be in various county departments. And those funds are put out under contract. They get a certain allocation each year, and those funds have not increased for quite some time.
You're talking about the state funds?
It gets to be pretty much year to year, you know, that they are maybe, they'll be through the funds after a few months, and then the county, if there are indeed services that need to be offered, they either will find maybe a long-term care program the individual is eligible for, or there may be a patchwork type of services that will be put in place to kind of assure their safety.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I got confused. Did you mean that the state money is what is contracted? I'm sorry, I just got confused on the source.
There are two pots of money that, mm-hmm. that GWAR administers overall to all of our counties and the tribes. Is their Older Americans Act dollars and then their state dollars that go into various programs. For the elder abuse funding, that's all state money. The state, through DHS, has a contract with GWAR for the funds that are then distributed to our 70 counties for their elder abuse services. You know, all of our allocations are always based on an annual contract.
Okay. And you said the allocations haven't changed in years.
Not for many, many years.
When's the last time you saw an increase or change in the allocation?
The original allocations didn't happen until the early 1990s. And at that time, the minimum was about 10 grand. At some point in time, it had to be more than 15 years ago, even went down a little bit. So the minimum the smallest counties might get is 9,900. And that is the allocations are based on a number of factors, including the number of older adults, especially frail elders that may be in a particular county. There's some census figures used in that formula. DHS would be better able to explain that to you, but it's, as I said, they've not increased that allocation.
Okay, and that's specifically for the investigations?
There are a number of areas for which these funds can be used. So a county may use it for just direct services in response to a particular situation they've been investigating. If they have access to other funds to provide for that, they can also use these funds for the time the social workers, for that social worker time. The counties are sent a memo in the fall as to the allocation time coming up. They have to submit a budget and and some goals around that. And then I review those, typically approve them, but there are a number of areas in which they can use those funds. And we really do pretty much leave it to the expertise of the social workers or the Human Services Department to decide, yeah, this is an appropriate use for these funds because we have access to other funds for this program or for certain supportive services. They can use the funds for legal services. You may have an individual who is in need of a protective, some legal papers of some, maybe even guardianship at some point in time.
So when you're getting these budgets then from counties, what are you seeing that they're requesting to use the money for?
It really varies. I would say the majority of it is used for supportive services, and those have to be short-term. Typically, if they do an investigation, say it's for self-neglect, by state statute, for them to look at a case as being self-neglect, the individual that they're looking at has to be in significant risk of danger, like in such a bad situation that if some intervention isn't done, that their health could really suffer, or their safety could really be questioned. And we have to premise this all with, if they go to the older individual and say, somebody's called us, we can't tell you who, but they're very concerned about your safety, could I come in, could we have a chat? Remember that just because the person is older, as an adult, as a competent adult, they still have the right to say, go away, I'm fine, leave me alone. Even though a social worker may know that a few weeks, a couple months, they're going to be calling us again, saying, why aren't you doing anything? And social workers, I'll say, Daniel, social workers wind up doing that sometimes, is having to explain to neighbors or family or whatever, you can make the call. They cannot even tell them whether they're opening investigation. There's the privacy factor, confidentiality. But all they can say is the individual has a right to say thanks, but no thanks. You don't lose your... I tell people, you don't lose your constitutional rights just because you turn 60, that you continue with that until the day you die, unless you are found incompetent, and then there may be some other kinds of interventions. And in some cases, the question of their capacity, their competency may come up, and part of that legal process might be to look at the individual being assessed for that. And the social workers' trained eyes and their ears, what they're hearing, what they're seeing, can help them decide whether this is something that we can't just turn around and go away. We need to bring in another professional to see if indeed they're incompetent and it's time for some other services to be provided.
So in the work that you're doing then, what do you feel is needed? Is there something missing that would help a great deal?
Yeah, I couldn't say any one particular thing because every case is so individual. But I think for the social workers, they'd say they're seeing a lot more where people are... self-neglect is probably more than half the... I would say probably 30 to 40% of the cases in the state. That's gone up over the last few years, I think, because people... do see, especially with the aging population, there are a lot more older adults that may be in a particular area or a neighborhood, and people be concerned about that, make a call. but I think certainly the need to provide supportive services for people to be able to maintain their independence as best they're able. It's a big thing for us in the aging network is that people are able to live where they want to live for as long as they're able, and the supportive services for that. So it's not just funding for elder abuse. It's funding for all the supportive services that would help that person. Wisconsin's fortunate we have, if you're familiar with the family care program or the IUS program, which are long-term care programs for older adults or people with disabilities who are very low income. I think then, and we're so fortunate in this state to have just a great network of aging disability resource centers. So being able, for the social worker, be able to, if they don't work out of the ADRC, to be able to work with the ADRC and look at what are some other supportive services that might be brought in. It could be the caregiver is just really stressed, maybe needs some training, maybe needs a couple hours off, maybe get some respite in there to kind of let them kind of gather themselves, ensuring that they have access to training or a support group that they get to once in a while.
So with the cases then of elder abuse that you see where you said, you know, maybe it's a family member providing care, but they're neglecting or threatening and things like that, is it just because they're stressed or is it intentional?
I don't know. Yeah, that I couldn't tell you. I don't know what the statistics would be on that. But I think certainly a caregiver, you're just like any other individuals. You could have an individual in a family who's been put in a caregiving situation who really doesn't have the tools to do that, may have their own, quote-unquote, issues of their own. They may have AODA issues. They may have mental health issues. They could just be overwhelmed by it all. But we also, in the field, will say that caregiving is not an excuse for abuse. And it's really important that if a caregiver is identified, if the health professional maybe can make them aware of, you know, we have this aging disability resource center. It's right here in our county, or it's right here in our tribe, where you can get information. They can help you get training. You don't have to do this alone because you can't and you shouldn't. Because over time, the caregivers, we know that, the caregivers can really start to fail as well. So we try not to point fingers. Instead, we're going to listen to what's going on and how, if this person wants to continue to be in this position, how can we help them do that so that not just the older adult is okay, well taken care of, but that the caregiver, himself or herself, is also able to do okay.
The bottom line that you would say is that the money is not keeping pace with the demand that you're seeing.
Oh, yeah. We have counties that they'll contact me by, you know, sometimes even by May or June, that their allocation is gone. And because elder abuse is a mandated service, the counties are mandated to have a designated lead elder abuse agency, and that they will have provide the services as needed. They can't turn their back on an older person and say, well, we don't have funds for that. And as I said, it could become then a patchwork of looking at what services could be brought in then to help them kind of get stabilized. These aren't dollars that can be used for long term. And sometimes when an individual's in such a difficult situation, especially if it's a self-neglect type situation, maybe a good chance they're eligible for a long-term care program of some kind. If they have assets, the ADRC, the Aging Disability Resource Center, can work with them to figure out, okay, if I bring in these particular services, I can, you know, get by okay, because they're a little worried about their nest egg. You know, saving for a rainy day, even though they may be in a, you know, a really bad storm. You know, for a lot of, especially for older women in this state, a good number of them are, in fact, very low income. And if they're not able to take care of themselves and being able to bring in some supportive services to help them maintain their independence is what we really aim for.
So then in cases where, you know, counties run out of their allocation, then they're expected to find it somewhere else within their budget.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, that's the patchwork. It's there may be other services, whether it's respite services for that caregiver, some kind of supportive home care services that are brought in. It could be a transportation. It could be a volunteer to do the provide the transportation to help them get to their appointments or get to the senior dining site. You know, it's there's just a number of different programs and areas where they could bring in services to help that person. But if they, you know, if they have some high cost services that they are not able to afford, and the county is saying that they need them, then the county then has to ante up. And typically that might be related more to if the person is just not able to stay where they are and some kind of intervention has to be done where maybe they need to temporarily, maybe they've had to go to the doctor, the doctor's saying they've got all these maladies, maybe they've got some really bad sores or something's going on, maybe diabetic and not taking care of themselves and getting them seen to, you know, through the healthcare system. And then maybe they need to recuperate or spend some time at a CBRF or in a facility of some kind before they can really go home and being able to return home to where they'll be safe. And that can, you know, and again, I mean, that could be a situation, self-neglect, where not only are they not taking care of themselves, they're not taking care of where they live. They may hoard. They may just not be able to keep up with demands of maintaining a household, that kind of thing. And if we know about those situations earlier, you can bring in some in-home services to help them, you know, maintain their dwelling and such, whether it's an apartment or a home or wherever the particular living situation is.
So from what you're hearing or seeing, that 30 to 40% of cases you've seen, that's self-neglect where the people aren't taking care of themselves, the older folks aren't taking care of themselves.
Yeah, and through no fault of their own, often. You know, you have a 87-year-old with maybe, you know, arthritis, vision impairments. Maybe she's had a knee replacement and the other one's really bothering her. You know, maybe she just does not get out very much, doesn't have any socialization. Oftentimes these are individuals who may be fairly isolated.
What about the federal piece? I mean, we've been talking a lot about the state funds, but what about the federal dollars that you allocate to counties?
Well, the federal dollars we allocate to counties typically are those dollars that are used for those services that are that all of the aging offices in the state have access to. Those are dollars that can be used for nutrition, transportation, information assistance, minimal caregiver supports. And for GWAR, we have staff that work in those various areas, have that expertise. So they work with the county aging offices on training their staff and program development and such. It's the elder abuse side of things is for those agencies, they're typically different. They're a different agency than typically our other staff would work with. I work primarily with those departments, and oftentimes, as I said, they're human services departments. Whereas when we're working with aging units, typically it's the Aging Disability Resource Center, quote-unquote down the hall from human services.
So I guess given that, I mean, do you see an opportunity for more coordination or collaboration between aging units, ADRCs, and human services and social services?
Oh, no. I think they collaborate very well. I mean, in a human services agency, they would have designated, there would have been a county board resolution as to who's going to, what entity is going to be the ADRC. And the same for the aging units. Aging units as well are, that's a county option as to designating what agency is in their state is going to be the aging unit. And now over the last many years, as ADRCs have developed, a lot of that coordination is very much at the local level and then with the various state players. We have a strong role in that as the Area Agency on Aging. We our mission is to ensure that those local services are doing for older adults what older adults want, what they need. We have a big thing. We in the Aging Network is we have a buzz phrase. It's seniors in charge, and everything they do, including the Aging Disability Resource Centers, has input at the grassroots level from those older adults and what they would like to see happen in their communities, what they think would work best for them. So there are lots of committees on aging, the human services boards. In a county where the aging unit is a nonprofit, mm-hmm. they also have like a commission on aging. And it's just, if you're not familiar with the network, it's just oftentimes people don't until, you know, they're in a crisis or something. But it's, you know, we've been doing this for many, many years. I mean, we've had this arrangement for county aging offices and the elder abuse agencies going back many, many years.
Again, you've been listening to Jane Mullins with the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us next Monday. Until then, have a great rest of your week.